Mr. Hutchinson informed me that it normally took a pretty good kid 3 to 4 weeks to make gold. I smiled inside, knowing that I had made it in under 2 weeks. During that visit, Gordon informed me that my court date had been moved up a few days. "So, when do we go to court?" I asked.
"The day after tomorrow," he answered. "You going to be okay?"
"Yes, sir," I said, trying to sound sure of myself, when inside I was terrified.
"David, I'm not going to confuse you on what can or cannot happen when we get in the courtroom. I've seen enough to know that some cases can go either way, and you have one of those cases. I can only tell you to keep your cool, and if you believe in God, I recommend you pray."
Alone in my cell, I could feel myself become lightheaded. I closed my eyes, turned off my anxiety, and prayed. 2 endless days later, I sat perfectly upright as I strained to remember everything Lillian and Gordon had fed me. I nodded to Lillian, who sat behind me, and I smiled to her. As I turned away from her, I saw Mother sitting to the right of me in one of the front row seats. I closed my eyes for a moment to make sure they weren't playing tricks on me. But when I opened them, I could see Mother cradling Kevin in her arms. My feelings of confidence evaporated.
"She's here," I whispered to Gordon.
"Yeah? And remember, keep your cool," he warned.
Moments later, my case number was announced. I squirmed in my seat before stealing a glance at Mother. My lawyer, whom I had met only a few minutes earlier in the outer chamber, stood up, rattling off dates and other official-sounding numbers and statements so fast that I wasn't sure whether everything he stated was about my case or someone else's. The judge acknowledged my lawyer after he returned to his seat. From my right, another man in a dark suit cleared his throat before he spoke. Gordon leaned over and tapped me on the knee.
"No matter what he says, keep your cool. Don't smile, don't move, and don't show any emotion."
"Your Honor, on or about the week of January 10, the minor, David Peltzer, after extensive premeditation, did knowingly commit arson and attempted to burn a classroom at the Monte Cristo Elementary School." A slow panic began to consume my body. "The minor, Your Honor, has an extensive history of extreme rebellious behavior. You have the brief from the minor's psychiatrist, as well as statements from the minor's teacher and staff members of Monte Cristo Elementary. I have statements from the minor's former social worker, who also claims that while David's naivete can be rather enchanting, he does at times require close supervision. While residing under the most liberal foster conditions, David has displayed aggressive behavior toward others and has, on occasion, been argumentative and disruptive while in foster care." I sank into my seat. The same building that had granted me freedom would now be my doom. After an eternity, the other lawyer thanked the judge before taking his seat, then nodded to Mother.
"Did you see that?"
I asked, nudging Gordon.
"Shh," he warned. "Don't blow it." "Roboto," the judge sounded bored, asked in my direction.
"Your Honor," my lawyer chuckled as he stood up, "Ms. Gold's statement is taken totally out of context. I submit that His Honor take the time to read the entire text. As for the charge of arson, the case has been founded on purely circumstantial evidence. While David was initially the suspect for the charge, I have in my possession statements attesting to the fact that David stopped the spread of the fire set by another minor. As for behavior reports while under detention, David has been, and I quote, exceptional. As for David's foster placement, the Catanzas eagerly await David's return. Thank you, Your Honor." The judge scribbled down some notes before nodding at the other lawyer, who sprang from his seat. "Your Honor, while no direct corroboration has yet been made, the minor has an established pattern of extreme dysfunctional behavior. In addition, I have a signed affidavit from the minor's biological mother, Mrs. Peltzer,
stating that the miner has set several fires in the basement of his former residence. Mrs. Pelzer regrettably confesses that she could not control the miner under any normal conditions, and that the miner is extremely manipulative and harbors violent tendencies. Please review the order transferring custody dated last March. Your Honor, it has become dramatically apparent, for whatever reason, that the minor cannot be managed in his former home setting or in foster care. The county believes that the minor is an extreme burden to society. The county hereby recommends the minor to be immediately admitted to psychiatric evaluation for possible admission into a facility that can best support his needs.
What does all that mean? I asked Gordon after the lawyer was through.
Before Gordon could even hush me, the judge rubbed his temples and asked, "Juvenile probation?" Mr. Hutchinson buttoned his coat as he stood. "Probation recommends continued monitoring and consultation from a different psychiatrist. I have seen nothing to make me believe that David is a threat to himself or to others. I recommend replacement with David's foster guardians."
"Gluttons for punishment, are they?"
The judge chuckled before continuing. "Prior convictions?" he asked as he turned to my lawyer.
"None, Your Honor,"
the lawyer stated as he leaned forward.
The judge leaned back into his chair. As his eyes looked down on me, I could feel the hairs on the back of my neck begin to rise. I moved my left hand to scratch my right arm. I held my breath, waiting for the judge's answer. The judge fingered his mustache. With a sudden nod of his head, he turned to the court reporter. "Pending no further verification on the charge of arson, the court recommends sentencing of 100 days in juvenile detention, honoring time already served." "And off the record," the judge stated, "young man, the charge of arson is a most serious one. The only reason I'm not sentencing you for that is I have no direct proof. While it appears you may not have committed this crime, you have, in fact, been skating on thin ice for quite some time. You appear to have some good qualities and ample guidance," the judge said, nodding to Mrs. Catanza. "But be wise enough to employ them both." Immediately after the judge struck his gavel, Gordon whispered, "You'll be out in 34 days." "But I didn't do it," I whined.
"Doesn't matter," Gordon stated matter-of-factly. "That's really the issue. Believe me, kid," he said, pointing to the judge, "that guy's a Santa Claus. If the prosecution had any hard evidence, I'd be fitting you for a straitjacket for the funny farm right about now. Besides, the old man has a soft spot for scrawny little wimps like you. Come on, back to your cell, you animal," Gordon choked as we stood up. Without warning, Mother stepped in front of Gordon and me.
"You're wrong! You're all wrong! You'll see! I warned that social worker broad, and now I'm warning you!"
Mother screeched as she thrust her finger at Mr. Hutchinson.
"He's bad! He's evil! You'll see! And next time he'll hurt somebody! The sooner that boy is dealt with, the sooner you'll see that I was right, and I didn't do a damn thing wrong! You're fooling yourself if you think this is the end of it. You watch! There's only one place for that boy! You'll see!"
Then she stormed out of the room, yanking Kevin behind her. I inched my way to Gordon, whose face was chalk white.
"Where does your mother live?"
"At home,"
I replied.
"Oh," Gordon asked as he raised his eyebrows. "The home you burned? I mean, if you burned the basement, you must have gutted the house, too."
"Yeah,"
I laughed after I realized he was only joking.
34 days later, I cried as I stuffed my collection of arts and crafts projects and the folders of schoolwork I had acquired into a small cardboard box. In an awkward sense, I didn't want to leave. In the outs, the outside world, it was too easy for me to get into trouble. While at Hillcrest, I had grown used to my surroundings. I knew exactly what was expected of me. I felt safe and secure. As Cara Miguel escorted me to the front desk, he explained that the outside world would indeed be the real test of my survival.
"Pels," Carl said as he took my hand,
Hope I never see you again. I returned Carl's handshake before I gleamed at Mrs. Catanza, who seemed shocked at the sight of my pants, which I had grown out of.
Well?
She asked.
How's my turtle? I inquired.
Right about now, I'd say he's soup.
Mom!
I whined, knowing Lillian was only teasing me.
Come on,
I said as I spread my fingers.
Let's go home.
Lillian's face lit up like a Christmas tree when she realized that this was the first time I had called her house my home. She took my open hand.
Home it is.
Chapter 8 Estranged. Things were never the same after I was released from juvenile hall and returned to the Catanzas. The other foster kids seemed to eye me with suspicion. Whenever I walked into a room, they would suddenly quit talking and flash me fake smiles. Whenever I'd try to join in on a conversation, I'd find myself standing in front of everyone with my hands buried in my pant pockets. Then, after an eternity of silence, I'd leave the living room, feeling stares on the back of my neck. Even Big Larry, whom I once considered my big brother, brushed me off before he moved out. After a few days of the cold shoulder, I found myself spending all of my time fiddling in my room. I didn't even care that my Murray bike began to rust. One Friday afternoon in July 1974, Gordon Hutchinson dropped by. I felt a surge of excitement as he marched up the stairs and to my room. I couldn't wait for someone to talk to. But I knew by his grim look that something was horribly wrong.
"What is it?"
I asked in a low voice.
Gordon placed a hand on my shoulder.
"You need to pack a bag," he said with pity.
I brushed his hand away. Visions of Hillcrest filled my head.
"Why?"
I exclaimed. "What'd I do?" Gordon gently explained that I wasn't in any trouble, and that he knew about the struggle I was having at the Catanzas' home since I had moved back. He also stated that he had been trying to move me into another foster home with fewer kids.
"Besides,"
he confessed,
"I'm in a jam. I got a bigger kid being released next Monday from the Hill, and, well, he's been assigned to live here. So come on now, move it." I wanted to cry. But instead I ran to my room. My heart raced from a combination of excitement and fear of not knowing what was going to happen to me next. With the speed of lightning, I flung drawers open, yanked clothes from hangers, and stuffed everything I could into a large brown grocery bag. Minutes later, I stole a moment of time to take a final look at the room I had slept, cried, played, and spent so much time thinking in for just over a year. Even when I had thought that my world was crumbling around me, I always felt safe and secure in my room. As I gently closed the door, I closed my eyes and yelled at myself for again being so stupid. The first two ultimate rules of being a foster child that I had learned while at Aunt Mary's were never to become too attached to anyone and never to take someone's home for granted. And I had foolishly broken both rules. I had been so naive as to convince myself that I would live with Rudy and Lillian for the rest of my life. I closed my eyes as I fought back the tears. After Gordon placed a phone call to another foster home, he had to separate Lillian and me as we sobbed in each other's arms. I looked into Lillian's eyes, promising her that I would be a good boy and that I'd stay in touch. Outside, Gordon swung open the door to his brown Chevy Nova, then hurled my belongings in the back seat before allowing me to slide into his car. As he backed out of the driveway, I could clearly see the streaks of black mascara run down Lillian's face. She stood in front of the same living room window where I had spent so many endless hours, waiting for the remote possibility of a visit from my father. As I waved goodbye to Lillian for the last time,
I suddenly realized that she and Rudy had cared for me and treated me better than my own parents. Neither Gordon nor I spoke a single word for several minutes. He finally cleared his throat. "Hey, Dave, I know this is all coming at you pretty fast, but why?" I whined. Gordon's face tightened with frustration. "Listen," he barked. "It's rare, damn rare, that a kid stays in a home for as long as you did. You know that, don't you? And you were there for how long? Over a year? Hell, that's a record." I sank in the seat, knowing that everything he was saying was true. I had taken so much for granted for so long. I turned my head to the window, watching familiar parts of the city zoom past. Gordon broke my concentration. "Hey, David, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have dumped on you like that. It's just that sometimes I forget what it's like to be a kid in your position. You see, I had assigned you to another home yesterday, but I got stuck in court before I could pick you up, and, well, now that home has another kid, and, hell, I don't know what to do with you." "You could take me back to the Catanzas," I suggested in a soft voice.
"Can't do that. Like I already said, I had signed you out of the Catanzas yesterday, which means they're no longer your legal guardians. It's, well, very complicated to explain. The bottom line is, I've got to find you a home."
As Gordon stumbled for words, my heart seized with fear. I suddenly realized that I had forgotten my bike, and more important, my pet turtle. Gordon laughed when I told him, so I playfully tugged his arm. He knew how much my things meant to me, but we both knew finding me a place to stay was far more important. Gordon stopped off at his home. Soon the phone became glued to his ear as he pleaded, then begged foster parents on the other end of the line to take me in, if only for a few days. After several hours, he slammed down the phone in frustration.
"Damn it," he said. "There are never enough homes, and all the homes we have are full."
I watched him as he again attacked the phone. Seconds later, his tone changed. Even though he turned his back to me, I could still hear him quietly ask, "What's the count on A-Wing?" "Yeah? Okay, put a bet on hold for Peltzer." No, he's clean. No charges. I'm just trying to place him, and I'm running out of homes."
"Okay, thanks.
I'll give you a call before we come in." As Gordon spun around to look at me, he realized I knew what was about to happen.
"Sorry, David, I just don't know what else to do."
I was so mentally exhausted I no longer cared. In a strange way, I actually looked forward to the routine at the Hill and seeing counselors like Carl Miguel again. Before I could tell Gordon to drive me to the Hill, he snapped his fingers and grabbed his jacket, streaking out the front door and ordering me to follow him to the car. Inside the Chevy Nova, he gave me a sly smile.
"I should have thought of this earlier. It's impossible for some of these parents to say no once they've had a good look at you kids. I know it's a raw deal, but desperate times call for desperate measures."
I squinted my eyes as I tried to understand what Gordon's words meant. Before I could ask, my chest jerked forward as he jammed the gear shift into park.
"Well," he proudly announced, "this is it. Put on your best face."
Gordon surged with pride as he rapped his knuckles on the screen door. A split second before he marched in. I felt like a burglar as I tiptoed into someone else's home without permission. A pair of heads popped out from a nearby kitchen.
"Just be cool and have a seat," Gordon gestured to a couch before giving me a wink.
He spun on his heels and opened his arms.
"Harold! Alice! Good to see you! How have you been?"
He strolled into the kitchen. I shook my head and chuckled to myself at Gordon's chameleon-like personality. I knew if he wanted to, he could charm anyone into anything. He reminded me of those crazy guys on TV who desperately try to con people into buying cars.
Before Gordon pulled up a chair at the kitchen table, I knew we were in trouble. The man, Harold, who was wearing a straw hat, shook his head.
"Nope. Can't take any more. Got's no room," he grumbled as he took a drag from a thin cigarette.
I clutched my already crumpled bag and was about to stand up to leave when the lady, Alice, said,
"Now, Leo, settle down. He looks like a good kid."
Alice leaned over and gave me a smile. I raised my eyebrows and smiled back.
"We're not licensed for boys, you know that," Harold stated.
Gordon butted in. "It'll only be for a few days, just until I can find him another home. I should have a place for him by, let's say, Monday, Wednesday by the latest. You'd really be doing me and David a big favor."
"And the papers?"
Alice asked. Gordon raised a finger.
I don't have them with me, but I'll bring them by next week and we'll just backlog the dates. Hey, look at the time. I gotta run. Thanks again. I'll see you next week," he said, and fled from the house before Harold and Alice could change their minds.
I sat glued to the couch, hugging my bag to my chest. I kept my head bent down while Alice and Harold eyed me with caution and crept into the living room.
"Well, where is he going to sleep?"
Harold asked in a stern tone. After a small squabble, Alice decided I would share a room with Michelle, a 17-year-old foster child who worked at night. Harold continued to protest, claiming that sharing a room with a young lady was not proper. Trying to make a good first impression, I marched up to him, looked him straight in the eye, and shrieked,
"Oh, it's okay. I don't mind."
As the words spilled out, I knew I was in trouble. For the next 4 nights, I curled up beneath a set of old wool blankets on the living room couch. I didn't know why I had made Harold so upset, but at least I had a place to stay. For that, I was thankful. The next week, after taking a quick survey of my contents in my grocery bag and waving goodbye to Alice, Mrs. Turnbow, I climbed into Gordon's car as we set out for another foster home. He assured me that he had discovered the perfect home. Even though my new foster parents had never had any foster children before, and only received their license yesterday, my head began to swim with emotions. The more Gordon tried to convince me about my new foster parents, the more I knew how desperate he was to place me. A half mile later, Gordon parked his car in front of a small brown house. Stepping out of the car, I exhaled and gave the woman who stood on the porch a false smile. Before Gordon could introduce us, the woman flew down the stairs and smothered me against her chest. My arms hung from my side as the woman's sandpaper-like hands scoured my face. I wasn't sure what to do. I thought the woman mistook me for another child. After an eternity of cheek-pinching and another round of bone-crushing hugs, the lady held me at arm's length.
"Oh, just look at you!"
the woman cooed, as she shook my shoulders so fast that my head bounced up and down.
"Oh, I could just eat you alive! Gordon, he's so cute!"
"David!" the woman shrieked as she jerked me up the stairs and into the house.
"I've waited so long for a boy like you!"
I stumbled into a small living room, fighting hard not to lose my balance. The moment my head cleared, the crazy woman shoved me onto her couch. Gordon tried his best to calm the woman down by forcing her to read endless stacks of papers before assuming custody of me. Finally, he sat her down and explained everything he could about my character over and over again, emphasizing the fact that if she had any questions, to give him a call.
"Oh, not to worry,"
the lady said as she smiled at me and seized my hand. "A little boy like this should be no problem at all." Gordon and I blinked at each other at the same moment.
"Well, then," he chuckled, "I'll be on my way and let you two get to know each other."
I walked Gordon to the door. Without the lady knowing, he bent down and whispered,
"Now be a good little boy."
I cringed, as he knew I would.
After Gordon drove away, the woman flopped onto the couch. She batted her eyes and shook her head from side to side for several minutes. I thought she was going to cry.
"Well, just look at you."
I returned her smile, and without thinking, I stuck out my hand. "I'm David Peltzer." The woman covered her mouth with her hand.
"Oh, how silly of me. I'm Joanne Knowles, and you may call me Mrs. Knowles. How's that sound?"
I nodded my head, knowing full well that Joanne thought of me as a kid rather than the 13-year-old teenager that I wanted to be recognized as.
"That's very kind of you, Mrs. Knowles," I replied.
In a flash, Mrs. Knowles sprang up from the couch and proudly showed me a framed picture of her husband.
"This is Michael," she cooed. "Mr. Knowles. He works at the post office," she stated as she cradled the photograph to her chest and patted it as if she were holding a child.
But I felt better after finally meeting Mr. Knowles, who insisted that I openly address him as Michael. I knew by the look on Joanne's face that she didn't like Michael's easygoing nature or having her rules challenged. She would always seem to bite her lip in front of Michael. But the moment he left for work, she would return to treating me as if I were a toy doll. Joanne insisted on washing my hair, prohibited me to ride my bike past the corner of the block, and instead of the $2.50 allowance I had received from the Catanzas, she proudly dropped 2 quarters into the palm of my hand.
"Now don't spend this all in one place," she warned.
"Oh, don't worry, I won't," I assured her, wondering what to do with 2 measly quarters. Because of Joanne's restrictions, I spent most of my time wandering through her home. The living room was smothered with every item from the Avon catalog. I'd spend hours gazing at the thousands of articles. By early afternoon, I became so bored that I'd plop down in front of the television and watch speed racer cartoons. When I couldn't stand another animated episode, I'd drag myself to my room and kill time by coloring in a coloring book she had given me. Just as when I lived with Mother, I seemed to know when something was wrong. Even with my bedroom door closed, I could hear hushed disagreements turn into raging battles. Several times I heard Michael yelling about my presence in his home. I knew that having me as a foster child had been Joanne's idea because, as she had told me, she was lonely and couldn't have any children. Whenever Joanne and Michael fought, thoughts of Mother and Father raced through my head. I fully realized I wasn't in any physical danger, but I stayed huddled against the far corner of my room with a blanket over my head. Once, a few days before school started, their yelling became so extreme that the windows to my bedroom would shake. The next morning I tried to talk to Joanne, who seemed to be on the verge of a collapse. I stayed by the side of the couch the entire day, watching her clutch her wedding picture to her chest as she slowly rocked back and forth in the chair. As quietly as I could, I tiptoed to my room and packed my clothes into my weathered brown paper bag. At that moment, I knew it was only a matter of time before I would be moving on. My problems with the Knowleses evaporated my first day at Parkside Junior High School. I sat tall and proud at the big round table in my homeroom class. I smiled at the other boys who openly joked with me. One of them, Stephen, nudged me, claiming that a girl from the other table kept looking at me. "So?" I asked. "What's the big deal?"
"If you like a girl, you call him a horror," Stephen explained.
I tilted my head to one side. While I thought about the word Stephen wanted me to say, the other boys nodded with approval. After extensive coaching from my new friends, I tried to be cool as I bent over to the girl and whispered, "You're the best-looking horror I've ever seen." The entire room, which had been rumbling with noise, suddenly became quiet as a church. Every head swung toward me. The girls at the table clamped their hands to their mouths.
I swallowed hard, knowing I had screwed up again. When class ended, the entire room full of kids fought for the door. The moment I stepped outside, the sun seemed to disappear. I gazed straight up and stared into the face of the most gigantic eighth grader I had ever seen. "What'd you call my sister?" he sneered. I swallowed hard again. I tried to think of something clever to say. Instead, I told him the truth.
"A horror?"
I whimpered. A second later, warm blood gushed from my nose. The eighth grader's fist was so fast that I didn't see it coming. "What did you call her?" he repeated. I closed my eyes before giving him the same answer. "Smash." After six blows to my face, I realized I shouldn't say the word horror because it meant something very bad. I apologized to the gorilla-sized kid, who struck me again and bellowed, "Don't you ever, ever call my sister a whore again." That afternoon at Joanne's home, I stayed in my room as I tried to fix the frames of my bent glasses. I didn't seem to notice that Joanne stayed inside her room as well. As the days passed, I so desperately wanted to ask her and Michael what a whore was, but I knew by the way they acted toward each other that I'd be better off keeping my problems to myself. A couple of weeks later, returning from school, I found Joanne with her head buried in her hands. I rushed up to her. She whimpered that she and Michael were getting a divorce. My head began to throb. I sat by her feet as she informed me that Michael had been having an affair with another woman. I nodded as Joanne wept, but I didn't know what she really meant. I knew better than to ask. I held her until she cried herself to sleep. I felt proud. For the first time in my life, I had been there for someone. I turned off the living room lamp and covered Joanne with a blanket before I checked my belongings in my grocery bag one last time. I lay on my bed knowing deep in my heart that I had somehow been one of the reasons for the Knowles' divorce. 2 days later, I turned my head away from Joanne, who wept from her porch as Gordon eased his Chevy Nova down the street. I dug into my pant pocket and pulled out a crumbled piece of paper containing the addresses and phone numbers of all my former foster homes. Borrowing one of Gordon's pens, I drew a line through Joanne and Michael Knowles. I didn't feel any remorse. I knew that if I thought about my feelings toward Joanne Knowles, Alice Turnbow, or Lillian Catanza, I would break down and cry. I felt I was beyond that. Carefully, I folded my address sheet and stuffed the paper back into my pocket. I cleared my head of any feelings I had about the Knowleses, or anyone else, as I glanced out the car window. My eyes blinked. For a moment, I thought Gordon was driving me to Daly City. "Are you going in the right direction?" I asked in a squeaky voice. Gordon let out a breath.
"David, we've run out of foster homes. The only one left is a home by your mother's." I felt a lump creep up my throat.
"How close?" I whimpered.
"Less than a mile," Gordon replied in a dry voice.
I nodded my head as Thomas Edison Elementary School came into view. I calculated the distance from my old school to Mother's house to be under a mile. I could feel my chest begin to tighten. The thought of living so close to Mother made my heart skip a beat. But something seemed out of place. I nearly pressed my face to the side of the window. The school looked radically different. "What happened?" I asked, shaking my head from side to side.
"Oh, it's a junior high school now. That's where you'll be going."
I let out a sigh. "Doesn't anything stay the same anymore?" I asked myself in a sarcastic voice. A flicker of excitement over seeing my teachers that had rescued me soon vanished. Only when Gordon wheeled his car away from the school in the opposite direction of Mother's Street, did I breathe a little easier. I felt as if I had stepped into a time warp as the Chevy Nova chugged up streets that were lined with houses of the same style as Mother's on Crestline Avenue. I couldn't believe how small they seemed. Strangely, though, I felt secure. I let out a smile as I marveled at the tall palm trees in the front yards of the single-story homes that seemed so tiny now. I couldn't believe it had been nearly 2 years since my rescue. I rolled down the window, closed my eyes, and breathed in the moist, chilly air. Gordon parked his car at the top of a steep hill. I followed him up a set of red-colored stairs to a house that looked identical to Mother's. When the front door opened, my eyes nearly popped out of my head. Gordon leaned over to my side.
"You gonna be all right? You're not prejudiced, are you?"
I shook my head as my mouth hung open.
"Prejudiced?" I asked.
I had never had black foster parents before. A tall lady shook my hand and introduced herself as Vera. I automatically took my position on the living room couch as Gordon and Vera talked in the kitchen. My eyes darted in every direction, searching every corner, every beam of Vera's home. The entire floor plan seemed the same. I remembered that the walls of Mother's house usually reeked from the thick, choking smell of cigarette smoke and the heavy stench of animal urine. But Vera's home had an open, clean feeling to it. The more I gazed at Vera's home, the more I smiled. Minutes later, Gordon sat down by me on the couch. With his hand on my knee, he warned me that Mother's house was off-limits, with a radius of 1 mile. I nodded my head, understanding the meaning of Gordon's order. But I was frightened of Mother finding me. "Are you going to tell her where I'm at?"
"Well," Gordon began as he fought to say the right words, "by law, I'm only required to inform your mother that you are residing in the city limits. Other than that, I really don't see a need to tell her anything else. As you can tell, I'm not a big fan of hers."
Then his facial expression changed.
"And for God's sake, you make damn sure you stay the hell away from her. Am I clear on this?"
"Like crystal," I replied, giving him a salute. Gordon playfully slapped my knee as he got up from the couch. I walked him to the door and shook his hand. Having Gordon leave me in a strange home was the hardest but most familiar part of our relationship. I always felt a little scared. He seemed to always sense it.
"You'll be fine. The Joneses are good people. I'll check in on you in a few weeks."
Vera gently closed the door behind Gordon, then led me down a narrow hallway.
"I'm sorry, but we weren't expecting you," she explained in a kind voice as she opened the bedroom door at the end of the hallway.
I stepped into a vacant, white-walled room containing a twin-sized mattress on one side of the wall and a box spring on the other. Vera reluctantly explained that I would be sharing the room with her younger son. I gave Vera a false smile as she left me alone in the room. Very slowly I plucked my rumpled clothes from my grocery bag and stacked them in neat little piles by the head of my box spring bed. I killed time by rearranging my clothes as if they were in a dresser drawer. Suddenly I closed my eyes and cried inside at the thought of never being with the Catanzas again. Later that afternoon I was introduced to the 7 other foster teenagers who lived in a makeshift room in the garage. Mattresses were crammed into every corner, and any other open space available. A pair of old lamps gave the room a soft glow, and makeshift bookcases were used to store whatever belongings the teenagers possessed. I shrugged off whatever anxiety I had after meeting Jody, Vera's husband, who chuckled like Santa Claus as he hoisted me so high that my head almost struck the ceiling. I quickly learned that no matter what was going on, whenever Jody came home, Everything and everyone came to a halt and competed for his attention. As cramped as things were, there was a genuine family bond. I only hoped I would stay long enough to memorize their phone number. My first day at Fernando Rivera Junior High was a huge improvement over the one at Parkside Junior High in San Bruno. I kept my mouth shut and my head down. At recess, I desperately tried to find out what happened to my former teachers, only to discover that they had been transferred to other schools across the district. I felt empty and sorry for myself, until one day I made friends with Carlos, a shy Hispanic boy. We shared most of the same classes, and at recess we'd stroll throughout the school. We seemed to have a lot in common, but unlike my friend John at Monte Cristo Elementary, Carlos didn't have a mean bone in his body. Because Carlos couldn't speak English very well, we didn't feel a need to talk to each other that much. In an odd sense, Carlos and I had a way of knowing what the other was thinking just by our expressions. We soon became inseparable. At the end of the school day, we always met by our adjoining lockers so we could walk home together. One day, out of boredom, I convinced Carlos to walk across the street to the new Thomas Edison Elementary School. As Carlos and I strolled down the corridors, I couldn't believe how puny the other kids looked. Loads of children bubbled with laughter as they raced to the play yard or for their rides home. With my head bent to the side, I turned a corner and bumped into a big kid. I muttered an instant apology before I realized the kid was my brother Russell. His head reeled back for a second. My eyes examined his every feature. I knew in a flash that Russell would let out a blood-curdling scream, but I couldn't break away from staring at him. His eyes flickered. I felt my body tense the way it always did the moment before I sprinted away. My head leaned forward when Russell's lips began to quiver. I sucked in a deep breath and told myself, "Okay, David, here it comes." "Holy cow! Oh my God! David, where did you... How the hell are you?" Russell asked with a choking voice. My mind raced with all my options. Was Russell for real? Would he strike out and hit me or run and tell Mother that he saw me? I turned to Carlos, who raised his shoulders. I wanted so badly to hug Russell. My mouth suddenly went dry. I'm fine, I stuttered, shaking my head. You okay? I mean, how are you? How's things at home? How's Mom? Russell's head dipped to his worn-out sneakers. I realized how withdrawn he looked. His shirt was paper-thin, and his arms were spotted with small, dark purple marks. My head snapped up to his face. I knew. I shook my head, not knowing what to say. I felt so sorry for him. For years I had been the sole target of Mother's rage. Now in front of me stood my replacement. "Do you have any idea what she'd do if she ever found out I talked to you?" Russell said, his voice trailing off. "Things are bad. I mean, real bad. All she does is rant and rave. She drinks more than ever. She does everything more than ever," Russell said, again looking at his shoes. "I can help," I stated with sincerity. "Really, I can. I gotta go." Russell spun away, then stopped and turned around. "Meet me here tomorrow after school." Then he flashed me a wide smile. "Hey, man, it's really good to see you." I walked forward. I felt an overwhelming urge to be close to him. I stuck out my hand. "Thanks, man. I'll see you." Afterward, I smiled at Carlos. "That's my brother." Carlos nodded. "Sí, hermano, sí." I thought about Russell the rest of the afternoon. I couldn't wait to see him the next day. But what can I do? I asked myself. Would Russell come to Jody and Vera's home with me, so Jody could call the police and maybe rescue him as I had been? Or did I imagine the marks on Russell's arms to be abuse rather than battle wounds from playing hard? Maybe, I thought, Russell was trying to set me up like he did years ago, when he planted candy bars in my rag box, then ran off to inform Mother that he had caught me stealing. He then had the privilege of watching me receive my punishment for my crime. Mother had trained Russell to be her spy, but then again, he was only a small child back then. That night I tossed and turned in my bed, wondering what to do. Sometime in the early morning hours, I finally drifted off to sleep. In my dream, I found myself waiting for her. My head tilted to one side when I heard Mother's forced breathing. Our eyes locked for a moment. I saw myself walking toward her. I wanted to talk to her, to ask her, to plead with her. Why me? Why Russell? My mouth moved, but the words didn't come. In a flash, Mother's face turned cherry red. No! I yelled at myself. You can't keep doing this. It's over. The shiny razor-edged knife suddenly appeared above Mother's head. I tried to twist my body and run away, but my feet failed to respond. I tried to yell her away. My eyes followed the knife as it flew out of her hands. I knew I was dead. I screamed for my life, but I couldn't hear my terror. My head bounced off the floor. I found myself scrabbling to stand up. I stood alone in a dark room, unsure whether I was awake or still in my dream. I strained my eyes, searching through the darkness. My heart seemed stuck in my throat. My God, I said to myself. What if I'm still there with her? I emptied my lungs when I recognized the sound of Jody's son snoring in his bed. Grabbing a piece of my clothing, I held it to my chest as I waited for the sun to come up. The next day after school, I physically dragged Carlos to Thomas Edison Elementary. "This no good idea," Carlos stated. "Your mamacita. She loca," he said, twirling a finger to the side of his head. I nodded in agreement. I had decided after my nightmare that nothing would keep me from seeing Russell. Carlos and I stopped in the same hallway as the day before. A group of children screamed and yelled as they seemed to run through our legs. As the kids grew bigger in size, I twisted my neck in search of Russell. My eyes found him at the far end of the hall with his head bent down. "Russell!" I shouted. "Over here!" Russell's head bobbed, but he didn't make eye contact as he had the day before. I felt something tug on my arm. I smirked at Carlos, whose eyes darted in every direction. "This no good. Your mama, she loca," he warned. "Not now," I said, still keeping my eyes fixed on the top of Russell's head. "My brother, si, hermano, si? He needs help, like me, remember?" I said, pointing toward Russell, who slowed his pace. I leaned forward when Carlos grabbed my arm. "No!" Carlos shouted. "You wait here!" I brushed Carlos's hand away. Fighting my way against the tide of children, I made my way to Russell. Still walking, I extended my hand. Russell saw me, but for some reason he kept his head down. I stopped, mid-stride. My legs buckled. My arms seemed to just hang in front of me. Even before Carlos yelled, I knew something was horribly wrong. "Run, David!" Carlos shrieked. "Run!" I looked just above Russell's hair and saw Mother walking behind him with her head bent down. Mother's ice-cold, evil eyes locked onto mine as her face came into full view. Kids seemed to dance around her as they scattered in every direction. Inches in front of me, Russell stopped, then turned toward Mother, who smiled.
Her hand disappeared into her purse as she came closer still. For a split second, Mother's face seemed to hesitate as she withdrew a shiny piece of metal. I lost my balance when my arm jerked backward. I fell on my back, my eyes still fixated on Mother. Above me, Carlos began to drag me backward. I knew this had to be a dream, but Carlos's badgering made everything real. I struggled to stand up, feeling Carlos's hands lift me to my feet. I blinked my eyes and saw Mother's bony fingers stretch out toward my neck. She was so close I caught a whiff of her putrid body odor. In a flash, Carlos and I weaved our way through the mass of smaller children. As we fled, I looked behind me. Mother seized Russell's arm as she quickened her pace. Carlos grabbed my hand, leading me to the parking lot. My chest heaved from absolute terror and lack of oxygen. My arms swung wildly. I ran into the parking lot and again searched behind me. My eyes sought out any sign of Mother and Russell. Without warning, I tripped off the curb. As my body flew through the air, I tried to swing my head forward in an effort to regain my balance. A second later, my chest collided against the hood of a moving car. Behind the windshield, a woman's eyes grew wide. I felt myself rolling off the hood as I tried to grab anything that would keep me from falling. My hands slapped the far end of the hood, fingers flailing as I tried to latch onto the wiper blades. I closed my eyes and felt my body sink in front of the car. My eyes burned from the sound of my own scream. A moment later, my head struck the pavement. I heard a screeching sound. I tried to cover my head with my hands. Somewhere in the crowd, I heard someone else scream. I closed my eyes and emptied my lungs. Seconds later, I uncovered my face and peeked through my fingers. Inches in front of my nose were the grooves of a front left tire. Carlos plucked me from the pavement. I drooped an arm across his shoulder as he led me to the sidewalk. I looked back at the car. A young woman flung open the car door and stood and shook. Without skipping a beat, Mother marched at full speed to her station wagon. Without my saying a word, Carlos understood my fear. My legs felt rubbery, and he had to practically drag me up the same small hill that I had years ago raced from into Mother's waiting arms before we left for the river. Now that same hill seemed to be my doom. My legs became tangled. My knees scraped the sidewalk, and my teeth were clenched from the jolt of pain. From the top of the hill, Carlos and I could see small clusters of children and adults pointing in our direction. My eyes scanned the stream of cars as they emptied from the parking lot. I wouldn't know in which direction to flee until I spotted Mother. After a few sweeps, I shook my head. "She's gone. She's not there." Carlos grabbed my sore arm. "There!" he pointed. Mother's station wagon had climbed the hill in no time flat. I could see the rage on her face as she pounded wildly on her horn. Because of the traffic, she couldn't make her left turn. Carlos and I nodded to each other before running across the street and up another hill to his house. My energy seemed to come from nowhere, and my ears picked up the distinctive rumbling sounds of the worn-out muffler on Mother's ancient station wagon. Carlos and I bolted up the stairs to his house. He dug into his pockets and fumbled with the keys to the door. "Come on," I pleaded. Carlos's twitching fingers dropped the keys. Even though I could hear the sound of Mother's car chugging up the hill, I stood and watched the shiny reflection from the keys that tumbled down the stairs. "Keys!" I yelled at myself. Mother wasn't taking a knife out of her purse. It was a set of keys. Carlos's shouting woke me from my spell. I raced down the stairs and tossed the keys to Carlos, who jammed a key in the lock before flinging the door open. On my hands and knees, I scrambled up the stairs, rolled into Carlos's house, and slammed the door shut. No one was home. Creeping to the front window, we stayed glued to the floor and peeled back the drapes as much as we dared, just as Mother's station wagon rocketed up the street.
Carlos and I began to let out a laugh, until I heard the familiar sound of Mother's car creep down the street as she tapped the brakes every few feet, her eyes piercing into every house.
"She's searching for us," I whispered. "See," Carlos replied, "your mama, she loca."
After hiding behind the living room curtain for over an hour, Carlos and I walked to the halfway mark to Jody's home. We grinned at each other. His brown eyes smiled.
"Just like, James Bondo."
"Yeah," I laughed.
"James Bondo."
I shook his hand and nodded to him that I'd see him tomorrow. I watched Carlos stroll down the street, then disappear as he rounded the corner. I never saw him again. I jogged up the set of hills and didn't stop until I slammed the front door to Jody's home. I huffed behind the door for several seconds until I realized that Vera and Jody were screaming at each other in the kitchen. I cursed to myself, knowing that Mother must have just called. I sailed past the kitchen and into my room, knowing that Jody would soon yell for me. As I sat on my box spring bed, I knew I had broken one of the most important rules Gordon Hutchinson had pounded into me. Stay the heck away from Mother. Thoughts of Gordon driving me to juvenile hall.